First of all, Kathleen and Mary and I are so happy to be here with you again. We love working together. This is our 10th anniversary. This is 2000 was the first year we presented at APHA, so we're quite happy to be back, and we're happy you're here and care about what we have to say. As usual, I have no financial relationships to report. Here's what I'm hoping to cover. We'll see how it goes. I'm going to try and link the two talks together and talk about social justice and public health nursing, move a little bit more talking about suffering and the other, talk about where I see us in terms of social justice, public health nursing interventions, and nursing education today, and hopefully where I think we might think about going in the future. So as we've heard, I mean, we know historically from what we've learned as students, from what we've been hearing in our presentations at this meeting, that clearly social justice is linked to nursing and in particular public health nursing, given our history. I want to point out, though, in thinking about social justice as a concept, I want to point back to Boutain and Beckemeyer and Butterfield, who've got some literature out there that says that social justice, the concept, has been a little bit problematic in a variety of nursing documents, and they point to some lack of specificity and inconsistency in the use of the term. So I want to sort of continue in that vein and raise questions about Acheney's Essentials of Baccalaureate of Nursing Education, which came out in July of 2010. I want to point to three particular areas within that one competency. One, that it points to, quote, focusing on interventions that lead to the greatest good for most of the people, which is in opposition to many a philosopher who says you ought to be focusing on those in greatest need, not for the greatest good. The second bullet is that inequities, and I'm quoting again, threaten the common good, the consumer bill of rights and responsibilities of healthcare, supports the goals of social justice by delineating support for consumers and providing safeguards for individual health. I'm not clear about the link between a consumer bill of rights and social injustice. And in particular, I'm a little concerned about safeguards for individual health when I think, again, we ought to be saying over and over again that our focus should be communities and populations. And then third, the competencies are in ethics, not specifically in social justice. And why I point to this is I'm back to Kathleen's point. The language that we choose to use or not use is crucial. That's how we know each other, right, and what we're supposed to do. So in thinking about what justice is, most of the literature talks about justice as being the sharing of burdens and benefits. And so then you have to think about, well, how are resources allocated? So as Mary says, you know, we're clear that there's tons of inequities and disparities across the U.S. in terms of wealth and in terms of how healthcare is distributed. And the notion is, but we're pretty okay with that. And if we're not okay with it, we at least tolerate it because there's not lots of movement to undo any of that. My state undoes that stuff all the time. So I think, and I'm going to quote Sister Donnelly here in an article that came out this summer, is that, you know, we're all for social justice and we can raise that banner, but what does that mean? Well, then what do we do? And my question is, how do you know what to do if we aren't more explicit about framing the problems that we face in terms of social justice? So why care about injustices? I'm coming from a perspective that I think we need to think about injustice as being a form of suffering. And Ricoeur talks about, and I'm quoting him here, suffering is not defined solely by physical pain or even by mental pain, but by the reduction, even the destruction, of the capacity for acting or being able to act. So suffering is more than the visible. It's what's not seen. It's the inability to tell a story, to be listened to be heard. And referring back to Chuliarki, who Kathleen referred to, she says, if the sufferer cannot speak, cannot tell his or her story, how can the sufferers convince others to take action to address their condition? She says, the lack of action to relieve their suffering means that their suffering, quote, leaves no trace. And I think it haunts back to Cornel West telling us, you have to let suffering speak. We have to hear that and be witness to that. I'm also, I refer back to Georges, who has a great article about suffering, who noted that although suffering is a social experience shaped by political realities, such as racism, sexism, all those isms, suffering is usually viewed as interior to the individual who, in Mary's words, lives in an apolitical, acontextual universe. We have no ownership for the suffering that is incurred by many of the people we see out there in the world. So why the ongoing sort of tolerance to these injustices? I would submit that suffering is tolerated because it often happens to the other, and we see ourselves as disconnected from that person or those persons. And in that way, that suffering is seen as something that is normal, as something as that's the way things are, and that we are not linked or responsible for the suffering of others. So the questions then get raised are, well, are we afraid of being like the other? Is it because their suffering reminds us we're one job away, mortgage payment away from being that person? Again, referring back to Ricoeur, who reminds us we are all bound up in each other. We are all simultaneously vulnerable and all capable. One of his points is, you can't understand who you are. I can't understand who I am without knowing it against you all, right? So you have to have a counterpoint or a counterpart. But Ricoeur says, it's a reflected image. That counterpart is also someone who calls him or herself I. So it's also someone who also thinks, who desires, who cares, who suffers, who needs, all that sort of thing. So back to why think about suffering and why care about injustices and inequities and what you're going to do about it. So you have to think about what's your framework of why you think those things happen in order to know where to go in creating interventions. My perspective is that suffering comes from power exerted by social, organizational, institutional, and economic injustices. And that says if you believe that, then those sorts of, you cannot create change if you work on changing behaviors or changing lifestyles or changing genes or that sort of thing. It means you have to target those sorts of bigger entities. One of the other points I want to make is that modern medicine actually also creates the dangerous other through the processes of curing disease, because medicine creates these boundaries between the sick and the well. So how do you develop relationship with people who are often seen as dangerous when it's often mediated by technology? So how do you find the real person behind technology? So when I worked in a local Denver hospital here years ago, I clearly remember the day I was taking care of a guy post cardiac cath who developed chest pain dysrhythmia, right, crashing. So they rolled his cart down the hall back to the cardiac cath lab, and I clearly remember he was surrounded by six or seven providers, and where were they all looking? Up at the monitor. Not one person talked to this guy who's just in a panic about what's happening to him. But I think we can't be comfortable, so I'm a pointy head academic, so I think this happens in education as well. Students are often afraid of, when we send them out to clinical practice, of those dangerous others, right? So again, how do you develop empathy and compassion when you hold those people at a distance? And technology happens in education as well. So I've read of literature that proposes, don't worry about talking to homeless people, we'll do a computer simulation. Then you don't have to interact with people who smell bad or are scary, right? So I think it raises interesting questions for us who are out in practice and for us who are in education. So I took a look at the literature, and I went back about 5 years and I searched PubMed and all and looked just at justice, social justice, and nursing. And what I found, now, here's a disclaimer, I probably missed your article if you wrote it, okay? So forgive me on that one. But I found very little that use explicitly those words. Much more if you look in disparities, right, and inequalities, but not those words specifically. And most of them are descriptive. You know, here's people who have really imbalances in how they get care. Or there are articles like Kathleen and me and Mary write about, yay, social justice, and we really should be doing it. When I did look at the interventions that tried to frame it in terms of social justice again, and it's not saying these are not right, but it's that they target health services and not what I see as sort of those bigger institutional entities. And again, there is some discussion in terms of curricular, but not a lot. But I did want to leave us with, I'm not going to go in these in detail, I don't have time, but I want to point out some examples that I thought target those bigger institutional things that we ought to be thinking about. One, couple of them actually looked at food insecurity, and rather than coming up with an intervention that says, how do I make you less hungry, they actually looked at, maybe we ought to looking at how employable are they, or do something about the income structure. Several projects coming out of Wisconsin, again looking at nutrition or at environmental changes. I'm particularly interested in this movements within several public health departments that have specific projects and centers with the words justice or equity in them. And if you ask me later, I'll tell you the text that I got those from. In terms of education, where are we now? Our sisters in Canada are doing some great work in terms of talking about social justice, and they say it's a core curricular threat across the whole curricula, but also in particular within community health practica. Now, I want to point out, I think these are two important things from my perspective. There are tons of articles that talk about community health practica. I worry about the ones that get framed solely as cultural experience for students and not framed as justice, and here's why. I think when you think about and frame it that way, culture is static. We watch those people and we understand them or get to know them, but we don't change them because culture is sort of sacrosanct. If you frame an injustice, it comes with it this sort of, you better do something about it if there's some injustice going on. The other thing, and this is from Cohen and Gregory, who talk about their recommendation is to strongly use non-health sector settings, jails, food banks. Also, they recommend using non-nurse preceptors. Their perspective was that non-nurses could understand the broader implications than the nurses that they had using as preceptors. And then finally, Boutain has got some work where she has tried to look at do students get the social justice part? And she did some evaluation of the students' clinical journals. The main story I want to leave you with is Kathleen and I are sitting in the middle of a dilemma now. So we talk about social justice all the time and how much we believe in it. And we teach a course every year. And frankly, we've had a discussion in the past several months, so we're coming up teaching it, and about how hard it is, and frankly, we just want to do something easy. Putting students in those big groups and listening to the angst of that every year, working with agencies that change their mind in the middle of the quarter. We got an email yesterday that the clinical faculty we were going to have isn't available. And so we're like, okay, but yet we are convinced that this is something important and that we need to just get over it and work through some way of giving students the experience that we think they need. But I must tell you, sometimes it's just frustrating. So these are my personal perspectives where I think, you know, we need to think about going is interventions that are at a bigger level, not just healthcare services. Thinking about if people's lives are better more broadly, are they eating? Do they have shelter? Those sorts of things. Some guidelines about specify how to teach social justice would be great. Even if we're teaching it, are they retaining it over the long term? Are we making some sort of difference, those of us who are in education? And to frame our approaches using the language of justice and inequities rather than social determinants and disparities, because I think it doesn't call us to action strongly enough. And then finally, scientific evidence alone will not solve the ills of the world. So from my perspective, evidence-based practice is necessary, but it's not sufficient. It isn't going to get us where we need to go. Betts, who has a great article, calls for something called democratic advocacy, which is to respond to the suffering that results from identity and difference. And it calls for us to engage with difference, with the other, but in particular, it calls for us to be different ourselves. This is not necessarily about those people out there, but about us in this room. This is really hard. And I don't know what more to say, except that this is really, really hard. But, you know, Robert Kennedy says it just takes one of us to make a difference. So, thank you.